So, Mayor, our first members-only bonus episode is now available. We watched the BlackBerry movie, the 2023 movie. It's the rise and fall of BlackBerry and how Apple kind of played into that. I think we both thought it was a pretty good movie, but we had a lot to discuss about the accuracy and some of the portrayals of the characters and the actual BlackBerry people. But I think we kind of got into all of that in the bonus episode.
Yeah, I thought it came out well. Nice little, you know, we're not professional movie reviews.
Yeah.
We gave our opinion, and there's definitely more Apple crossover than you might think.
Yeah,
definitely. Obviously, the iPhone took down the BlackBerry, but even, you know, throughout this, some parallels to how the company got started and how it kind of developed over time. And, you know, in the film, there's some nice callbacks with, you know, you see part of the Steve Jobs doing the iPhone keynote because that's part of the narrative, and, you know, how the BlackBerry was meant to react to the iPhone and stuff. So, yeah, we get into all of that into the special, which you can get if you're a Happy Hour Plus subscriber. Thank you to everybody that subscribes. And even if you don't subscribe, do check out the movie. It's BlackBerry came out last year. It's a good film.
And that's 9to5mac.com/join. $5 a month, $50 a year. You also get ad-free episodes and some post-show content every week. So this week, we have some follow-up. Last week, we talked about the information story and how developers were mad that you can't access the Vision Pro's cameras. And I made a comment about how it's different than accessing an iPhone's camera, because on an iPhone, you have the viewfinder where you know when an app is actively using the camera. Mayo, you pointed out that that was not necessarily the case, and we got some feedback backing you up on that.
Yeah, it's because obviously I'm a developer, right? So how the API works, you can request camera access and get approved camera access from the user and record from either the microphone or the camera without having to show any UI in your app. The notch area will obviously, or the dynamic island will show the orange or green dots, right? Which gives feedback. But in terms of the screen, and you know, a couple of OS generations ago, those dots didn't exist in the system, right? So there was a time when an app could completely discreetly record from the camera once it got initial permission. And I think there was a scandal with the Facebook app. Do you remember the old Facebook design where it had like the hamburger menu on the left, so it would like slide to the side?
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
So there was this time, there was a brief time where you could like switch from the camera mode in Facebook to share photos quickly to just the general navigation with the hamburger menu on the side. And there was a bug where basically the viewfinder layer wasn't getting removed when the person went to scroll to the side to do the navigation. So basically, yeah, it would keep the camera on. And people found this out and they were like, oh, you know, Facebook's recording. But it was just like a stupid like coding bug. But yeah, anyway, that was a proof positive of where the developer had obviously accidentally left the camera recording. But we got some feedback after the last episode that there are some legitimate use cases for this too. For instance, there was this app called Concert Camera. And basically what that did is it would show a full black screen. But the idea is you can hold it up while you're at a concert without annoying everybody behind you and dazzling them with your video feed. It would just quietly record the concert. And then when you're done, you could like click on the app screen and it would light up again. So it was like a legitimate reason for it to not show the live viewfinder.
That's clever. I didn't even know that was possible.
Yep.
Then last week in Happy Hour Plus, I talked about some of my smart home planning before me and my wife moved to Baltimore next month and my search for some sort of HomeKit camera, preferably HomeKit secure video, or and balancing like the lack of power and the power needs of a camera and no outlets and all of that chaotic stuff that goes into that planning. Got a message from listener Matt who pointed out Eufy cameras that use solar panels for power. So I haven't looked into this too much yet, but it sounds like it could be a solution for at least the camera we put in the back, over the back driveway. I don't necessarily know if I love Eufy. They've had some issues, but my theory is that if I use it all with HomeKit, then it should be fine, especially if it supports HomeKit secure video. But my takeaway, I think, from last week and some of the feedback we got and doing more research, I just need to wait until we're actually at the house and I can learn more about the power situation and see if it's feasible to try and run a cable from the back of the house to the driveway or what. It's hard to plan a smart home move when you're not actually at the house, I've learned.
Yeah. Yeah, the outdoor camera situation, which we talk about in Plus, but I was lucky. I could just replace my
right.
Like a light that was over the door or near the door. and I could just replace the light with wiring for the EV outdoor cam. If there wasn't wiring there or existing wiring for the light, it would have been a lot trickier.
Then one thing I didn't mention last week about smart home stuff is smart locks. So right now we have August locks on both of our doors, and those work good. But ideally, I would get something with home key. And I'm not entirely sure if that'll be feasible because we're renting. But I did get some feedback from Peter, who pointed out that Maryland is one of the four states in the United States that supports digital IDs in Apple Wallet. So you can store your driver's license in Apple Wallet. And he made the good point that if you could get a home key lock and have your ID in Apple Wallet, that's a pretty good setup. That's kind of having everything essential on your iPhone in the wallet app itself. Because home key, you can just walk up and tap it, which is good because it's like a walk-up townhouse. I'll have to look into whether that's feasible, but I would love to get both home key and my driver's license in Apple Wallet. That would be pretty sick.
Yeah, that Maryland's what, one of like four states
four,
in the US that supports that. And they announced it like 3 years ago.
Yeah.
It's just one of those things where it's going to take ages for
And there are questions about how useful it actually is, because get pulled over while you're driving, will the cop accept a digital ID? Do you want to hand over your phone to the cop to show them the digital ID? If you go to a bar, will the bouncer accept it to let you in? A lot of questions, but I feel like it's a good option to have in case you get in a situation where you do need it.
Yeah, and it's just convenient being on your phone or whatever, rather than you have to pull out your wallet or whatever. Like, that's the reality with those features for the time being, is that you still have to carry your wallet around, but you might have to get out of your pocket in some cases.
I did see somebody say that it's useful when traveling, because a lot of airports accept it. So if you travel, say you go on vacation, you lose your wallet on vacation, theoretically you have your ID and the wallet app on your phone, and you can hopefully get back home without having any issues with TSA. But yeah. Day to day.
You can't start a cultural change in how people show their ID without having the feature, right? So this feature was added to the system, I and many other people said, look, it's going to be there. It's going to take ages for it actually to get wide adoption. And that's exactly what's happening. But it will get there eventually, just like how, you know, contactless payments were really, really small to begin with. And then over time, Apple Pay has now become pretty pervasive.
Not at Walmart.
Not Walmart.
And finally, on follow-up, and this kind of, we put it in the notes as follow-up, but then it kind of grew into its own topic for this week, I think.
Yeah.
So we mentioned the App Store changes to allow game emulators for the first time. So we recorded on Thursday. Then on Saturday, the first game emulator app appeared in the App Store called iGBA. Then Sunday, it was removed. And Apple at the time said it was something to do with copyright and spam. But the issue was we didn't really know what the copyright was. Basically, iGBA was like a clone of Riley Testute's GBA for iOS app. And it's open source, but the licensing's not that clear that you could just use it for your own app in the App Store and put ads on it. Is that right, Mayo?
Yeah. So pre-Saturday, there was a license, but it implied that you would have to get explicit permission to release it to the App Store.
Right.
But it wasn't actually explicitly said. Obviously, the reason it wasn't explicitly said is that until 2 weeks ago, no one could ever get an emulator app approved on the App Store at all, so it was kind of redundant having it written there. Since Saturday, Ray Tester has updated the description, so now it says, like, it's open source, you can do what you want with it, except if you're submitting to the App Store, please get my explicit permission, blah, 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 blah. And obviously, iGBA did not have permission. It wasn't even like it didn't even take, like, the open source code and, you know, rework it into a different version. It was a pretty straight, lazy clone, except they took the opportunity to slap some ads into it, right? But kind of expect that to happen on the App Store. Like, Tester did complain that, like, he was upset that the app review didn't catch it. I don't really think that's a problem with, like, the initial submission. Like, you can't expect App Review to have a working knowledge of all software that's in a repo somewhere, you know? So, like, from their perspective, they had the app, they approved it, and obviously since then there was complaints about it and it got taken down again. Like, I don't think you can really, it's not really fair to levy the entire of the open source licensing world onto App Review, because what they're gonna, like, there's no way to trace back submitted binary to, like, source code, right? So, like, there's no real way for them to know. If the app's on the store, you can at least make the argument, well, the app's on the store in this other place and this person's copied it, but, like, GBA for iOS was never on the App Store because it was never allowed. So this was, like, fully new code and fully new assets to the App Store as far as App Review is concerned. And so they approved it, and obviously, then later it was taken down for the same copyright reason. That was the big ambiguity, because we said this on the show last week. the app review guidelines do not specifically say now, you know, you are allowed to make an application that can import a ROM file and play it as an emulator. It references emulators in other categories, and what's explicitly allowed is like Nintendo could make an emulation app that has all the Pokemon games installed, you know, in the binary, and then just because the games aren't running natively, but they're just as part of the download, that's fine. It doesn't explicitly mention a ROM-based system where you can just arbitrarily load any game you want that you can source from any source, reputable or not, and play it. Previously, that has always been rejected, but people perhaps optimistically thought that that would be allowed, and it turns out, yes, it is allowed, because IGBA did exactly that. I downloaded it on the weekend, and I fired up a ROM of Pokemon Fire Red, and it played perfectly fine. You're not allowed to obviously host Pokemon Fire Red game in the binary because you don't have the licensing for it. So you have to go out, and in the case of IGBA, or what is really GBA for iOS, you go to like Safari, download it, and then in the files app you can like click on it and it will open it in the IGBA app and basically import it that way. So you kind of have to know how to get the file in there, but once you do, you could play it and it would work. And then the app got pulled, and it was like, wait, did it get pulled because that review made a mistake in allowing a ROM-based application emulator, or are they responding to the code stealing situation? So we didn't know, and then Apple followed up a day later with like an explicit statement that said, "Yep, we removed it because of the claim from Riot Tester that the code was copied on without his permission."
So they said that it was explicitly approved based on the App Store guidelines around emulators. But yeah, the copyright was because of the similarities or the ripoff of Riley's app.
So now we're waiting for someone else to make an emulator that supports importing ROMs that isn't stolen. And it, from all intents and purposes, will get approved and stay on the App Store forever now.
And as we're recording and as we sit here, I just got a DM on Twitter from Dylan. And they say that there's another emulator popped up on the App Store. It's an NES emulator. Obviously, I literally just got this DM, so I haven't looked at it, but maybe they're coming. Maybe there's going to be like this big barrage of emulators of varying quality. But ultimately, this IGBA situation, even though it got really messy because of its similarities to GBA for iOS, it's ultimately great news for the future of emulating on iPhone and iPad, right? Because it's Apple giving its blessing to the model of importing ROMs.
Yeah, they've opened the floodgates.
Exactly, and they're taking their hands out of the situation.
Asterisk. Yeah.
They're taking a very
The only
real
constraint
approach
now is that you can't do a JIT, so you can't like run, you can't execute additional code on the fly, which prevents newer games from running at decent performance. So like GameCube and later, probably off the table. But all the handheld stuff, you know, GBA, DS, that should all be fine. So it will be coming.
So how would Nintendo take action on an app like this? Could they? Because Apple's very clearly says the developers are responsible for ensuring that their game emulating apps abide by all applicable laws. But the game emulating apps don't offer the games, like you said. So Nintendo's just going to have to try to like play a cat and mouse game with the sources of the ROMs themselves.
Yeah, I mean, if you call your app like Game Boy Emulator, maybe there's a chance that Nintendo could file on trademark grounds for using the word Game Boy, right?
Yeah,
but that's true. If you just had an abstractly named application that didn't have any inbuilt assets that are Nintendo's or anybody else's, I don't see how you have any legal claim over that whatsoever. It's exactly equivalent to like Plex, right? You know, people put loads of content in there that is stolen, and you know the copyright and licensing belongs to the Hollywood studios, but the Hollywood studios can't ban Plex because Plex is, you know, just an application, a library application on its own. So I don't think there's really a way for them to stop it. If Nintendo is worried about it, they should just make their own
app
that's like Pokemon Virtual Console, GBA Virtual Console, whatever they want to call it. You know, who's paying for Game Boy games in the modern day? Very few people. Make it available, make it inexpensive, and people just use that rather than, you know, doing these like hacks and workarounds and going through the web. So if they are worried about it, they should just release their own. So far, they haven't. And if they don't want to, that's fine. But you're not going to stop the kind of underground ROM community from existing, because GBA games are like so easy to distribute. They're like 3 megabytes in size. You know, like anyone can host them. So you don't, like newer games are bigger in tens of gigabytes. So like hosting costs becomes an issue. But for like GBA ROMs, they're so small. Anyone can host them or email them or do whatever. So you're not gonna open pan, you're not gonna be able to close Pandora's box once it's open there. And plenty of emulators exist on Android and have done for years. So
yeah,
you know, it's just an ecosystem that exists. It will be interesting, like what Riley Tester hasn't announced is whether he is going to bring, you know, his right. GBA for iOS or Delta officially to the App Store, which is a really well-made application. They're both open source, but so far they haven't been allowed on the App Store because of the previous rules, but now those rules have been revoked. Tester has not said that he's going to bring it to the App Store yet. I think he should. It makes sense. People use it a lot. But at least right now, he seems to be focused on shipping Delta in the EU through the Alt Store thing that he's running. But at least theoretically, he could just ship Delta for Delta, the App yeah. Store worldwide. But so far, he hasn't done that.
I think I mentioned last week, too, that there's an element of this where Apple is actively trying to disincentivize people from using Alt Store.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. Like, yeah, so like this is a great way for Apple to legitimately cripple the appeal of Alt Store, right?
Right,
like,
yeah.
You know, here's this one alternative App Store that had some draw and some people were interested in and had a compelling reason to exist. Apple's like, well, the software that you, and from Apple's perspective, anything they can do where they can legally and, you know, morally reasonably right. prevent third-party app stores from taking a foothold is great for them because, you know, they can support the law, but they don't have to support it in practice if there are no compelling alternate stores.
So good news for the future, hopefully. With a bit still, we know more, but there's still kind of an asterisk to all of it.
We're kind of just waiting for someone to make a legitimate Game Boy emulator, basically, that isn't stolen, and then it can exist on the App Store for perpetuity.
So there's going to be a lot of them, and I think most of them will probably suck, but then eventually we'll get the good one. And that'll be what really opens the floodgates and takes it mainstream.
Happy Hour this week is brought to you by LinkedIn Jobs. When you're hiring for your small business, you want to find quality professionals that are right for the role. That's why you have to check out LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn Jobs has the tools to help find the right professionals for your team faster and for free. As you're growing your team, it's so important to have high-quality candidates to interview so you know you're ultimately hiring the best person for the job. And LinkedIn makes it so easy to find them. They're not just another job board. LinkedIn is ubiquitous in the place you want to be for your job to be seen, with a vast network of more than a billion professionals. I know, for instance, that when my brother was looking for work last year, LinkedIn is the first place that he went to find a job. LinkedIn simply gives you access to professionals that you can't find anywhere else. In fact, in a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you aren't looking on LinkedIn, you are looking in the wrong place. Hiring is easy when you have that many quality candidates available. So easy, in fact, that 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. And LinkedIn is constantly working to make their hiring platform even better. They recently launched a feature to help you write job descriptions, which makes the process even quicker than before. So join 2.5 million small businesses that use LinkedIn for hiring. Post your job for free at linkedin.com/happyhour. That's linkedin.com/happyhour to post your job for free. Terms and conditions apply. Thanks to LinkedIn Jobs for sponsoring the show.
So the Humane AI Pin reviews are here. And they're pretty shockingly bad, I think, is the general consensus.
I thought they were going to be bad, but they're even worse than I thought they were going to be. Yeah.
Where do you want to start with this? Because there's the first aspect of it is from a hardware perspective, all of the reviews seem to agree that this little thing that you clip to your shirt, engineering-wise, is quite impressive. It's a very good demo. But once you go beyond that into practicality and actually using it in a day-to-day basis, it falls down pretty quickly.
Yeah, there's kind of like two buckets, right? There's the issues of, is a pin a compelling form factor to do computing through? And is the Humane Pin itself any good in terms of the features that they've implemented and what it offers? And it's also expensive, right? Like, I don't really understand why the pin has to cost $700. Like, it has a $24 a month contract, but at least with the contract, you're getting, you know, data access to the AI models, and, you know, those kind of subscriptions normally like $20 a month anyway. So the subscription, although it's high, I do kind of understand why it's there. The Rabbit R1 is the obvious counterpart to the Humane Pin that's also coming out soon. And their pitch is it's only $200 purchase and no subscription. But that makes me question like how they're even going to survive, because, you know, the server costs of running these things are really high. So the future of the Rabbit R1 seems wonky to me. Like, I don't understand how they can sustain a $200 flat fee. The Humane Pin is $24 a month subscription, which obviously pays for the services, the cloud storage, and you get the T-Mobile data contract with a phone number. But you also have to pay $700 to buy the PIN in the first place. $700 is really expensive for something that's just like a touchpad and a speaker. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's nothing to it. It's like an Apple Watch without a screen. Like,
there's the projector.
And the Apple Watches start at what, like $400?
Yeah.
$350? Like, I don't understand why it's a $700 device. Yes, it's nicely made with, nice materials and metal and aluminium and stuff. And like, but what is it? It's just like a cell. It's just like a small phone without a screen. And like, screen's one of the biggest expensive of phones. So I don't understand why this thing costs just $700. Even if it was cheaper, though, you're probably still going to be facing an uphill battle in terms of whether people want it. Like,
it could be $400, but I don't want to buy it just because, at least according to the reviews, it flat out doesn't work for most things.
Yeah, or it's really slow.
Yeah.
Right? Like, the thing is, like, what was funny to me about reading the reviews, and a lot of them obviously have video reviews now, and they show it in action, right? And they would ask it questions, and it wouldn't know what to do, and... But like, the questions we were asking were not like complicated things. They were just like simple tasks that Siri from 2011 could answer. You know, it's like they haven't implemented timers, right? And think about how much flack the HomePod got when it came out for not supporting multiple timers, right?
Yep.
Like, it was lambasted for it. It could do one timer, but it couldn't do multiple. And then, eventually, 8 months later, or a year later, they added multiple timers. But at launch, it didn't support it. People are like, you're paying $399 for the HomePod, and it can't even do two timers at one time. You know, so stupid. When Amazon Alexa and whatever else have been doing it for 5 years now, this, it can't even do one timer at launch. Like, let alone multiple, it can't do a single timer. It's like the most obvious thing. Like, what do people use their assistants do? They ask them to send messages, set timers, and check the weather, right? And so of those pinnacle, that's my 90% usage of a voice assistant is those three things, and maybe play music. And it can't do timers at all, which seems like a huge miss for the launch release. Even a basic timer system would have helped these reviews tremendously. But that's just one element, right? There's so many different things that it can't really do for you. The other thing that's kind of cool, you think about, you can carry a mobile pin around with you. You know, when you're out and about, you could like get directions to places. Nope, doesn't support directions. That's another area where it doesn't support it at all. Some of these things might come in time, but they didn't help themselves, right?
No.
By having so much unimplemented functionality in the release version. And there's not even like a beta for some of these features. Like, I think they said that times are coming in the summer, but you're shipping in April and it's not there.
In addition to the voice,
so many of the things that the Humane Pin just refused to do on these video reviews, for the fun of it, I'd ask my watch and it would do all of them. Like, play this specific song by Beyonce, played it perfectly fine. Play the latest play the newest song by this band called Lawrence, which I've never heard of, but they asked the pin to do it and it didn't know. Asked the Apple Watch and it brought up the exact song from Apple Music. Ask it the weather, here's the weather, do directions, set timers, do the timers. Like, even half of the trivia questions where the Humane Pin should be doing really well because it's backed by like ChatGPT or whatever else, the OpenAI models. Siri's got a lot better at random trivia. It's not perfect, but a lot of the things people just immediately went to asking this thing for the demo, Siri could already do. So like, where is the benefit? And it would do all of those things way faster. Because that's the other problem with the pin, is it's really, really slow to do anything. I don't know if it's because it's got like weak service to the cell towers. It's only got small antennas inside there. You can connect it to Wi-Fi, but people aren't going to do that because it's a pain. So maybe it's just like a function of cell service, or there's more of a significant server problem. Because I tweeted about this a bit the weekend and people were like, well, this is just clearly showing that, you don't want to use an LLM or voice assistants because they're slow. I'm like, no, that's not really true. You go to openai.com, the ChatGPT web interface, you ask it a question, it'll respond very, very quickly, about the same response speed as like Siri does, right? And you can ask ChatGPT on the web very complicated questions and you get very detailed answers very quickly. So it's not a function of, it's just backed by an LLM, that's why it's slow. There's some weirdness in there. And so I don't think they've done a very good job with this 1.0 release. The other thing is people complain it gets warm and hot to the touch. The battery life sucks. So I don't really see how you could not review this poorly. There were some people I saw try and draw comparisons to the Vision Pro, like,
yeah,
you know, people are lambasting the Humane Pin, but the Vision Pro also sucks, and why did that get much better reviews? I think it's very different in the sense that everything that Apple said the Vision Pro can do, it does, right? And
yeah, for the most
there's
part.
At least some category of stuff where it does it better than anything else, like watching movies.
Mm-hmm.
Is the product recommendable at $3,500? Of course not. And we've talked about this at length before. But it's not like they presented this vision of something and then what they shipped just couldn't do it and it would like die after 10 minutes. Like, that's just like Apple shipped a very solid device and it's up to you whether it's worth the price. And over time, they'll keep making it better and better. The pin promised so much and the marketing around it was so arrogant leading up to it. It really had to deliver and it fell flat.
There were a couple of things during the reviews that stood out to me. In one case was MKBHD talking about one use case that he had that he found actually useful, which was he was driving to the studio and had an idea for a video. So he pressed down on the pin and said, write down this idea that I had for this video outro. And I got to thinking, yes, that's cool. And his argument was he wasn't going to pull out his phone and write down that idea while he was driving. He still had to reach up and touch the pin. He could have just used Siri or Google Assistant or whatever to do the same thing. You can tell Siri to remember something and it'll do it.
And make a note. Yeah.
That wasn't a very compelling use case. Then in The Verge's review, David Pierce, because one of the features of the pin is it has the camera facing outwards and you can say, what am I looking at right now? So he's walking through New York and he looks at a bridge and he says, what bridge am I looking at right now? And the pin confidently says, that's the Brooklyn Bridge. And he's from New York, or he's familiar with New York. And he goes, no, it's not. That's the Triborough Bridge or whatever it was.
Mm.
And he had the knowledge to know that it had hallucinated or gotten that completely wrong. But if it were me and I said, what bridge is that? And it told me, I'd just be walking around for the rest of the day like a moron saying, hey, I saw the Brooklyn Bridge. I didn't see the Brooklyn Bridge. The pin told me the wrong thing. That underscores both the problem with maybe the hardware and the camera, but also the problem with the reliance on AI and large language models in general. Just you can't easily fact check what it tells you. And they're known to hallucinate or tell you things that are very obviously wrong if you know the answer, but it'll
right,
act so
confident.
You know
confident. When I use ChatGPT on the desktop, right?
Mm-hmm.
I ask it something, I get it to do something for me, it gives me an answer. If I question, if it's something where I need to validate the accuracy of it, I'll just like do a couple of backup Google searches, right? To just like confirm
exactly.
What it's told me is accurate. On a pin that has no screen, you can't do it. So like this whole marketing of like, because they were trying to push this, you don't need a phone. You know, this is a completely mm-hmm. independent device. It has its own phone number. It can do its own calling. It has its own data plan. You don't need to carry your phone around. It was just never going to be practical because you can't trust a thing without a screen. Like the projector's a joke, right? Like it's not a replacement for a touchscreen. You can't trust an LLM to get everything right. So you have to have a screen. And any product that doesn't have a screen is like a non-starter. It's these days.
Yeah.
And a touchscreen just has so much functionality and so much stuff can be surfaced and shown to you. If you don't have that, like, you're really, really limited. It's like an Apple Watch without a screen. Like,
to me, these reviews have kind of just shown that the Apple Watch is a really great product and it has the potential to get so much better once they integrate.
I mean,
just
look at the pin's physical design, right?
Yeah.
It's like a rounded rectangle pebble. It's literally like if you draw a line down it, the watch strap, it's literally an Apple Watch shape, you know? Like, except you clip it on your coat, which is then awkward because if you take off your coat when you go inside, you then got to unclip it and clip it on somewhere else.
Yeah.
Like, the watch, you can just always be on your wrist. And there are some people who don't like watches, fair enough, but the watch has a lot of utility. And also, in addition to getting a screen form factor, you also get heart rate, you know, step tracking, like all of this extra stuff comes along with it that the pin form factor is never going to be able to offer you. So, yeah, like that's the thing. The pin has come out the gate with bad reviews because they missed out a lot of functionality, it overheated. It's just unreliable. But even just the form factor of a pin, not necessarily the Humane one, but anyone, I don't think would get particularly positive response because I don't see the benefit over a watch. I just think the smartwatch is a great form factor. And I do not think Humane fumbled the bag so much by trying to approach this as this can replace your phone. And they did try and backpedal it in the last like month or so. And like, oh, it can just be a companion to phone. But the whole design of the product is this is replacing your phone. That's why it has a completely separate phone number, completely separate contact list, completely separate photos, you know, integration. They don't have an iOS or Android app, right? Like, if they'd have come to this with a, this is more of an accessory to a phone, it might have been a more positive venture, or at least has a more opportunity to succeed, because it could then have also offloaded so much of the work to the phone that they can rely on being in your pocket and increase battery life and not have to maybe even have a cell reception, right? Like, what if they only just communicated via Bluetooth to the phone and just relayed all the requests that way? Like, you could have a little pin that has lasts all day rather than one that has to be like swapped out three times with the battery booster thing, and then maybe even still dies before the end of the day. So
where do they go from here? Because I don't, if they want to increase their reliance on the phone and continue their backpedaling and say, oh, it's just a companion to your smartphone, A, that defeats all of their marketing, all of this hubris they've had during the years long of building up the hype around this product and not telling anybody what it was until, last year, I think we finally saw like a demo of what it was supposed to do. Do they have a roadmap to where they can pivot and say, okay, version one sucked, but we've learned enough from version one to make version two more compelling? And are they willing to put aside their, I don't know how to describe it, but the company is very pretentious. I don't know if that's the right word. They have very clear ideas of what they want the future to be and how they think the future should work. They think smartphones are bad. Are they going to sacrifice that vision to make the AI Pen 2 better? I don't know if they will. I don't know where they go from here. Short of getting acquired by somebody, maybe.
They've just had, like, I don't think the design of this product would be what it was if they hadn't just left Apple, right? Like, part of this is like a political, like, we hate Apple and everything we made at Apple. Apple's bad, so we're going to do this completely different thing that has nothing to do with any Apple product at all. Here you go. And they've just compromised their own product marketing for it. Like, kind of sucks that in the modern era, you kind of need to have good integration with iPhone and Android to succeed. But you can't just uproot that entire model overnight just because you're a small startup, right? And like do something different. You have to be within the market that's there. And I think they could have got way further with a pin that was designed with the smart, like the idea being you have a smartphone in your pocket, but you can have a pin for quicker access throughout the day, which is exactly what the watch is, right? Like,
yeah.
You can leave your watch at home sometimes if you want to, but most of the time the watch is designed to have the phone in the pocket. And then you could get in, you'd eventually get to problems of or constraints of the ecosystem where some features aren't available to third-party pins that Apple wouldn't have make available to the watch, right? You know, we've had that discussion before with all the EU antitrust stuff and the US DOJ complaint mentioned a lot of that. But you can go way further than nothing at all. Way further. And if they'd partnered on Android, they could have even done the thing where the pin has the same phone number as the actual phone, right? Because right now, it's like you send a text message. You've got to send a text message to the pin's phone number, not your phone number. There's so many obstacles that this thing is never going to cross. And even if you did get all those obstacles, I'm still not sure they can justify the general form factor of a screenless badge that you clip on your clothing. So it's got a really big problem. Some of their technology might be able to have value in terms of the way they integrate with LLMs and stuff. So maybe they'll get bought out or something like that. Or maybe they pivot entirely and like make app, you know, that's the other thing. Like so many of these features, you could just ship as an application.
Yeah.
You don't really need a separate hardware product at all. So I'm sure the company can go through some pivots and changes, but what they shipped right now does not seem particularly compelling, unfortunately.
One thing in the Verge's review was they gave it a four out of 10. That seemed high to me. So I went and I found the page on their website where they explain what their numerical ratings mean. A four is apparently mediocre, and they say it has multiple outstanding issues. A three is bad, not something we'd recommend. A two is a product that should be avoided at all costs, and one is utter garbage and an embarrassment. Based on at least my reading of The Verge's review and everybody else's reviews, four seems a little bit generous here. If you're saying three is the threshold for something they don't recommend, I think you got to give it a three or maybe even a two.
I think there's some sentiment of like rooting for the underdog there.
The underdog, like, that's raised $230 million in funding. It's not...
Yeah, but when you're comparing it to the trillion-dollar tech giants, like...
Yeah.
Like, I'd love smaller companies to be successful, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think it'd be great. This hasn't achieved it, and I don't really think there's much point, like, oh, should it be a 4 or 3 or whatever? Because no one's going to buy it.
That's the thing, yeah.
I'm not short of it. I'm sorry about that, but that is the unfortunate reality. And just wait a few more months, and Android and Apple are going to have so many AI announcements. We're going to be flooded with that stuff. It's going to make the utility of another product that's like AI-centric even less relevant. Like, there's such a barrier to getting people to carry anything that isn't a phone. Like, even the Apple Watch, as good as and useful as it is, the attachment rate is like 20%, I think. Like, 20% of people that have iPhones have Apple Watches. It might be less than that.
Yeah.
Like, Apple can't convince 8 out of 10 of the iPhone customers to buy an Apple Watch. That's Apple, right? Like, with all the advantages and all the homegrown ecosystem and built-in, you know, stuff and anti-competitive pressure, whatever you want to say, they can only convince like a fraction of their, you know, potential audience to buy into carrying a separate watch around.
And getting it's $300.
Also cheaper. So getting them to carry like anything in addition, because that's the thing, right? Let's say the pin was perfect and it was great and it was getting a 7 or 8 out of 10 on the rating because it did everything it did, it had some value. You're still going to want to wear a watch as well because you want to be able to see your notifications or track your heart rate or do a workout and see the metrics on the screen. Like, so then you're expecting people to have a phone in their pocket, a watch in their wrist, and a pin attached to some item of clothing. Like, it's just not going to happen. And headphones as well, right? Like,
yeah.
So I the form factor is problematic. The fact that it overheats is ridiculous. The fact that they didn't introduce many features at launch is also bad. But even if all those things are addressed, I think they've got a huge blocker just in the form factor alone. Happy Hour is also brought to you this week by Ladder. If you're anything like me, you have a certain tendency to put things off until the very last minute. Dentists, optician's appointments, filing taxes, that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's usually fine, but you shouldn't mess around and wait when it comes to life insurance. Get term coverage life insurance through Ladder today. Go to ladderlife.com/happyhour to see if you're instantly approved. You know, I've started needing glasses, and that moment, it kind of hit me like, I'm getting older, and stuff like life insurance somehow feels immediately more relevant. Life insurance gives you the peace of mind to know that your family will be taken care of if the worst happens. Ladder is a 100% digital service when you apply for $3 million in coverage or less. That means no doctors, no needles, and no paperwork. It's all done online. You just need a phone or laptop to apply. You fill out Ladder's application form, and their smart algorithms will work in real time and tell you instantly if you're approved. Ladder has no hidden fees, and you can cancel at any time. Get a full refund if you cancel within the first 30 days. And Ladder's policies are insured by insurers with long proven histories of paying out claims. And Ladder's customers rate them 4.8 out of 5 stars on Trustpilot. So if you've been thinking about getting life insurance, Ladder is the place to do it. If you aren't sure, but you just want some more information, then go on Ladder's website, fill out their online calculator, and you can see the costs and terms of the plan with no commitment. And as the cost of life insurance only goes up as you age, now is the time to act and get it done. So go to ladderlife.com/happyhour today to see if you're instantly approved. That's ladderlife.com/happyhour. One more time, ladderlife.com/happyhour. Thanks to Ladder for sponsoring the show.
So iOS 17.5 beta 2 is here, and it's another relatively boring beta in the grand scheme of things, but there's one key change. So last month, Apple announced web distribution. We talked about it at the time, but it's basically a way for developers in the European Union to offer their apps for download directly from their website. At the time, Apple said it was coming later this spring. The first beta of 17.5 kind of under the hood laid the groundwork for it. Then today, Apple confirmed that, yes, 17.5 beta 2 includes all of the things developers and users need to take advantage of web distribution. I think the big takeaway from what was announced and shown off today is more details on how exactly the feature works from a user's perspective. So it starts by you go to the developer's website, And you basically go through five steps to give that developer permission to install apps on your iPhone. Once you give that developer permission to do that, you then have three more steps where you actually install your first application. And you only have to give a developer permission to install apps one time. So let's say, for example, if Meta set up a web page where you could go and download Facebook, Instagram, Messenger, and WhatsApp directly from their website in the EU, the first app you downloaded, you'd go through that eight-step process of giving them permission to install apps, then installing the first app. Then from there, each additional app you installed for Meta basically just be a pretty straightforward three-step process. I think, what was your takeaway from this, Mayo? Because we both talked to Apple about this and saw some details about how it works. And I kind of walked away with the impression that for the most part, it's less restrictive than I expected.
Yeah, the restrictions come by the usual terms of core technology fee problems, right?
For developers, yeah.
Yeah. From the user side, I think this is pretty reasonable. Like, you know, criticisms are surely going to be levied against this from the usual suspects who are like, well, in the app store, you press one button and it installs the app. And here you got to do like eight steps, right? But it's really not that bad, right? It's very similar to the process on the Mac where up until recently to like install Audio Hijack to install the kernel extension thing that would perform the audio processing. You had to like open the settings app, go to the specific section, click approve, then reopen Piezo or Audio Hijack and then go from there. It's very similar to that. And like it pops up a little dialogue when you're on inside Safari and you're going to download the app. Then you have to go to settings, and at the top of settings, there's this little page where it says allow apps from. Then you can click on that and then you click allow. And then you go back to the website and you carry on with the app installation. So it's not obtuse. It's not complicated. It's not having to go to, you know, five nested menus. Yeah, it's a few steps, but I don't think it's particularly onerous. It's pretty straightforward. I think you can explain it to most people how to do it. So I don't see this as like, you know, some sort of malicious flow. It's pretty regular. And it does, you know, if you read the instructions at each step, it is giving you information about what the implications are of allowing this permission. It's not that much different from installing a VPN profile or a, you know, MDM configuration either. So it's in the same vein. I don't feel like they're overstepping here. It feels pretty average.
And they kind of compared it to Android, where it's fewer steps, but it's basically like a one-time toggle. You turn it on and then you can go nuts installing apps from any different source you want. Whereas Apple is making you do it on this developer by developer, then app by app basis, which I think is probably a good thing. Because with a lot of the EU stuff, we've seen Apple, like some of the scare sheets with external payment solutions that we've seen, those are a bit dramatic. Those are a bit maybe too far towards the, we don't trust our users to do the right thing.
Yeah, the payment sheet, the scare sheet that's a joke is the payments one where it has like that five paragraph, you know, size 40 text where it's like, this is insane. What are you doing? Like, and then there's like one little allow button at the bottom. It's like, apart from anything you're actually reading in the copy, it just looks stupid. a title that's five lines long. Like the raw design of the sheets for web distribution are way saner. Like they look like you're approving an Apple feature, you know, like normal size title, headline, you know, detailed sections with descriptions. It doesn't feel like they're purposely making it ugly, you know?
Well, they didn't want to do this from the start, clearly, because they waited for a couple months to announce it after announcing their initial DMA plans, but it's not malicious compliance necessarily. It's pretty straightforward. They clearly were told by the European Commission or somebody that, hey, what you've announced so far isn't good enough. And they clearly had this waiting in the wings and they said, okay, here it is.
Yeah. And most people before who would have had to go down the alternative app marketplace route to get their app installed outside the app store no longer really have a need to work with an alternative marketplace at all. They can just offer their app directly through their own website. So it cuts out a lot of hassle in terms of people that actually do want to do non-app store distribution.
It makes the alternative app marketplace idea just a lot less enticing.
Yeah.
And the developer,
why would you
just
do it? Why would you, if you're Spotify, right? Why would you go and worry about striking a deal with an app marketplace when you can just host the app on Spotify.com?
And because the operator of the app marketplace has to pay that 50 euro cent fee every time the app marketplace app itself is installed. For web distribution, you only pay the core technology fee after the, what is it, 1 million annual installs?
Yeah.
So they've kind
Which might be problematic for some folks in terms of figuring out how they're going to make money or whatever, but obviously it's a much better deal than the app marketplace thing where you pay 50 euro cent fee for the marketplace and then 50 euro cent fee for every app you install from the marketplace as well. So,
because theoretically, if you're offering an app from your website and you approach that 1 million number, can you just turn off downloads until it resets? You kind of have a decent amount of control to making sure you don't wake up financially ruined one day.
Yeah, you could turn it off, but I mean, who wants to stop customers from having to install their application?
Yes, it depends on your business model. If it's a free app that you're not making any money off of, that you're offering out of the kindness of your heart, then maybe.
That's fair. Yeah. Yeah, you just have to be careful because obviously like the 1 million resets every year, right? So you have to like keep track of your active user base and who's deleted or hasn't. But theoretically, yeah, you could turn it off.
But ultimately, good implementation here. I think it's still EU only. This strikes me as something that will probably only ever be in the European Union. I don't think I don't think it'll be in the United States at least anytime soon.
Unless if they're not forced to do it, they're not going to do it.
Yeah, I just don't think they'll be forced. I don't think any legislation here is competent enough to force this anytime soon. That's what I keep thinking about as we continue to go through this EU saga. Is that in the United States, we're so far early in the process of legislating Apple, legislating the App Store, that unless Apple, for some reason, takes a proactive approach, they won't. It'll be a decade before any of this stuff happens here. That's how far ahead the EU is compared to the US, for better or for worse. Something else may be prompted by legislation to a certain degree. Apple has said that customers and independent repair shops will be able to use genuine Apple parts in repairs starting later this year. I don't know. What's your read on this? Because there's not a whole lot to it. It just seems like good news for the most part, with the added kind of restriction that they're going to start using activation lock for iPhone parts in order to deter stolen iPhones from being disassembled for parts.
Yeah, but that's stopping thieves, right?
Right, yeah. But some of the legislation
we've seen... Thieves were like, the iPhone's activation lock, I guess we'll just strip it for parts. So if they can apply activation lock to parts individually, then that is an even bigger disincentive for theft. So that seems like a positive, at least from the customer side of life.
There's activation lock and then there's parts pairing, which I guess are really two different things.
Yeah. So the parts pairing problem is previously a repair shop would have parts that are perfectly functioning and working from another phone, but they couldn't use them to repair a customer's device because the identifier wouldn't allow it to work. So like if you put in a battery into the iPhone, it would say this part is not valid, blah, 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 it's not genuine, blah, 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 blah. And basically what Apple's saying now is starting later this year, assuming you have a genuine part that was originally manufactured by Apple, even if it didn't originate from the phone that you're repairing it from, it will now keep working. Because previously, if you were trying to use like the self-service repair website, you could only repair by buying a new part, right? So you have to go to self-service-repair.com, order a new battery, wait for the battery to arrive, and then put that battery into the phone. You wouldn't be able to get that battery and put it in a different phone. You wouldn't be able to buy the battery and keep it for later in case someone else came along. It was like paired to the phone that you were currently set to repair. Now it sounds like there's more freedom in that, let's say you've got an old iPhone 11 from somewhere. You could take out the battery of that and replace it with your failing iPhone 11 device. So basically they're just making it easier. And the parts pairing thing was the blocker before, but starting later this year, you'll be able to basically undo the parts pairing and apply it to a new device, and the phone will do the calibration for the part. So it does seem like a repair shop could acquire used phones, take the parts out of them, and then if someone else comes to them, you know, 2 months later, they could use their inventory of parts to perform a valid repair instead of to just throw all those phones away or recycle them, right, and have no actual like repair value to them. So it seems like a decent expansion of the program. Like you said, I'm sure it's related to legislation because the Right to Repair Acts have been going into effect around the world, and some of them have more stringent terms around parts pairing than others, but this obviously seems somewhat related to quelling some of the legal pressures.
Then finally this week, Mark Gurman at Bloomberg has some details on the first M4 Max. So he says that we can expect the first M4 machines to ship later this year. And his report specifically calls out something around AI. He says AI focused M4 chips, but he doesn't really offer any details about what that means or really what performance we can expect from the M4 series. There's no details on things like core counts, neural engine performance, whether the focus will be on CPU or GPU or neural engine performance again. But he kind of instead just lays the roadmap that yes, the first M4 machines are coming and they might be coming sooner than you think. And some of the machines that skipped the M3 generation are going to, of course, get updated as part of the M4 transition.
Yeah, Mark said that this will be the first time that all Macs will get M4. So like there'll be no outliers because like with the M3, the Mac Studio and the Mac Pro haven't got it, right? And it doesn't seem like that's going to happen.
He says there is like an M3 Ultra that would theoretically be in a Mac Studio still being tested inside Apple. But its fate is unclear. And if it's the fate's not clear by this point, I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, it seems like it's missed the window. But for the M4, every Mac is going to get the update. He says the 14-inch low-end MacBook Pro will probably get it by the end of this year. 24-inch iMac with M4 before the end of this year. And then the higher-end 14, maybe end of this year or maybe early 2025. And then you get a Mac Mini with M4 and M4 Pro configurations. Again, either see the Mac Studio with the M4 chip and the Mac Pro with the M4 Ultra chip. Hopefully the high-end Mac Pro gets performance that the Mac Studio doesn't, so it has more of a reason for being. But
because he does mention that for highest-end desktop Mac configurations, Apple is considering support for 0.5 terabyte of RAM, which is up from the current limit of 192 gigabytes. But does that mean for the Mac Pro and the Mac Studio? Does that just mean the Mac Pro? Is that the only differentiator for the Mac Pro? Still not a whole lot of details on that.
Yeah, we don't know if there's going to be like a quad Max chip for the Mac Pro or whatever, that wouldn't fit in the studio's thermal window, but would fit in the huge Mac Pro chassis. That was rumored to happen for the M2 generation, like the M2 Extreme idea. But then that was obviously, those plans were canceled and that didn't happen. So maybe they're going to try again or maybe not. We don't know yet. But
his comments on AI focused improvements kind of aligns with what we've heard about the iPhone 16 Pro in particular, where Apple's going to focus on the neural engine, focus on improvements to that, and maybe increase the core count of the neural engine, I think has been rumored. Maybe those improvements are what also are going to come to the M4 Max.
Yeah. I think that's probably sensible. Like, clearly, a lot of the features that Apple will be announcing at WWDC for its OSs are going to be based on on-device intelligence. So if they have ways to make them faster with newer hardware too, that's the selling point. And maybe there's some stuff on device that they can't do with the neural engine in the iPhone 15 chip and would require even bigger neural engine bandwidth. And so then it'll be exclusive to the newer phones in the fall. You can imagine stuff like, more advanced camera pipeline processing and things like that might require new CPUs or new neural engine chips. The M4 upgrades were not even had anything specifically AI hardware. They're going to talk about them in the context of AI, just like they talked about the M3 MacBook Air being the best consumer laptop for AI, right? So even if they were just like, here's 10% better CPU and GPU, they'd be like, these are the best chips for AI. It's just the buzzword of the moment. But yeah, it probably means you'll get GPU upgrades, you get CPU upgrades, and there'll be some emphasis on a more powerful neural engine. And the pace of Apple Silicon has been very rapid.
Like, yeah, it's
2021. I got my M1 MacBook Pro, and by the end of this year, they could already have a M4 replacement.
Is the M4 going to be your generation to upgrade?
Maybe, maybe not. Probably not. I'll probably wait one more and do M5 next year.
Even if all of the fancy or a lot of the fancy new AI features in macOS 15 are exclusive to something newer than the M1?
That's different.
That's different.
Well, it depends what they announce, right?
Yeah.
So that you have to stay tuned on that one. If June comes around and there's like loads of hardware exclusive features that the M1 can't run, I wouldn't like get a new laptop right then and then, but it would be a bigger incentive to upgrade to the M4 in the fall. But at least right now, I can't imagine there's going to be... I mean, we just don't know, right? We still don't really know what the on-device AI features are going to be. But in my imagination, feels like there's not going to be anything super crazy that's hardware exclusive right now. But I guess we'll find out.
Indeed, we will.
Because I guess just appending to that, the emphasis is going to be on iOS, right? So I can imagine there being a bunch of iPhone 16 exclusive AI features. Not completely sold on the idea that there'll be loads of like Mac exclusive stuff for newer chips. It, like, again, we'll find out, but it just doesn't seem like that's where their focus is.
So is this your year to get a new iPhone then?
Probably not.
So you're just going to sit by and watch everybody else use the fun new AI features and sit in the corner by yourself and be sad?
You make it sound so sad, but yeah, probably. I'm a consumer. I'm not trying to, like, I've got an iPhone 14. It's not that old, you know?
That is true. And again, if most of the iOS 18 features are, well, if they're on device, it depends on how far back they'll go. But anything that's presumably done with the Google or whatever that partnership will be cloud-based. So maybe you'll get to at least use those. It's really messy, ultimately, right now. We just, like you said, we just don't know.
I'd be surprised if most of the stuff if they announce in June, probably will support the iPhone 14.
Yeah, right? I think so.
Like, the question mark is what's exclusive to the 16 in the fall, and if they're holding stuff back or whatever. But for iOS 18, like the flagship stuff, I imagine it's going to have a pretty wide berth in terms of compatibility.
Yeah, I will buy the new iPhone 16 Pro for the sake of this podcast. Otherwise, I wouldn't.
Do you feel like you benefit from the iPhone 15? Now we're like 6 months in.
I think so. I mean, I've talked a lot about the camera improvements. That's the big thing.
Yeah.
The 5X
I would have never bought the max size though. So like the 5X zoom, literally irrelevant.
And also just it's still a lot of times where I pick up this phone and I just love the titanium, the design of it. It's so much better than the stainless steel was.
Do you use it caseless?
I've been using it caseless pretty much the entire time, except when I travel.
Okay.
I used the iPhone 14 Pro Max caseless some, but those stainless steel edges get so grimy and gross and scratched up. Having a case on it was just easier. But this titanium design, I said it a million times, it's just rock solid. So I think you are missing out a little bit, but you do you. You do you. Okay, I think that does it for this week. You can send us feedback, happyhour@9to5mac.com. We are on Apple Podcasts and all of the other podcast platforms where you can find us, leave a rating and review, tell your friends, all that. 9to5mac.com/join to get Happy Hour Plus. Again, to check out our BlackBerry discussion this week. I'm on Threads, Twitter, Mastodon, @ChanceHMiller, and Mayo. What about you?
@BZMayo.
All right. Thanks, Mayo.
Bye-bye.